Please. This Sunday show with EPIC, the Irish Emigration Museum, an interactive journey that shows how a small island made a big impact on the world. EPICCHQ.com.
Sunshine 106.8. Sunshine 106.8.
And you're very welcome to the Sunday show. And I'm delighted to be joined by my special guest this evening, Professor Robert Kelly. Professor Kelly, you're very welcome to the show. How are you doing?
Thank you very much for having me. I'm great today.
Now, of course, you are an eminent cardiologist. You're a specialist in lifestyle. You do a lot for promoting health. So I'm delighted to be chatting to you this evening. COVID, Professor Kelly, I suppose, was really a very strange time for us all. And I think a lot of us are still suffering the aftermath of it. Just to bring you back, I suppose, to that was a pretty tough period for you and for a lot of people working in health.
That was a really tough time, I think, for all of us, for the whole country, for those of us in healthcare. It was really tough. We had a lot of change that we weren't used to. And I think it was sprung upon us very, very acutely. And most of us really just didn't know what to do. So I work in the Beacon Hospital, which is a private hospital. The hospital was taken over by the state. That was a very challenging time. It was really, really a very personally challenging time. The patients were all coming with a new illness that, in truth, most of us didn't know how to treat. And on top of that, a lot of people were dying very prematurely in life. And everybody knew somebody who was dying and you couldn't go and see them in hospitals. And then you hear stories about doctors dying and you hear stories about people getting COVID from patients and dying. So it was really something that most of us as doctors wouldn't be used to at all.
And I mean, in terms of, you know, I remember I went and I got the antibody test before the vaccination, and I was told that I was positive for the SARS. So I did the Roche one and then I did the Abbott one. And I remember fellow journalists telling me, they were just, oh, you lucky thing, you're immune now. But nobody seemed to know what was going on. And I never remembered. I think I must have picked it up when I was in London on a trip. And then all of a sudden, it seemed to all just dissipate. And then there's after effects. But it's very strange. And now we're in a world, and it's almost hard to believe that we were all locked away. It's incredible.
Yeah, but I think we were trying to learn very much, very quickly. And I think, in fairness, if you look at the pharmaceutical industry, they were well ahead of all of us. There was a lot of government support to make resources available to pay for vaccines to be made. There was very much sort of collaborative work across the scientific community. So when the vaccines came out, the strains got weakened. The reason the test got positive again is because there was another strain of COVID. But the strains, as they went on, got weaker and weaker. Now, ironically, COVID's still around. I did a procedure list yesterday. Two patients rang in to say, I have COVID, Dr. Kelly. I can't come in for my procedure. Now, these are two patients who happen to be in their 60s. Last week, of course, was the midterm. I think some people were abroad. They may have picked it up on a plane or something of that nature. So it hasn't gone away. However, it's not as strong or as sickening of a strain as it used to be. And I think most people are at least going out to look for it. I'm sure there's a lot of people who have it who aren't testing. And at least people are being honest enough, say, coming to a hospital so you're not going to go and infect anybody else. So I'm not saying it's gone away. I think the other group of patients you mentioned is, I have lots of patients who have this long COVID illness. And long COVID illness is a situation that's largely time-defined. So COVID itself can last up to 3 months. So you get a cough or a cold. It's not gone away after 6 weeks. You're kind of going, well, I had COVID recently. This is very surprising. Well, the COVID can last up to 12 weeks. So it's not that it's gone in a week because you do the test and the test is negative at the end of the week. And you may, of course, pick up a pneumonia or a bad chest infection during that time. So it's clearly important to be checked over. But beyond 12 weeks, you come into a situation that some people still have symptoms. And the symptoms are often this kind of unexplained, profound tiredness is a really common one. Some people are a little bit sort of confused. They have what's called brain fog. Other people have a lot of heart palpitations and dizziness. And the interesting thing with the long COVID is it can go on, but most of the patients with long COVID are getting better. They're a very unusual cohort in that they're historically very fit, very active, look after themselves, who for some reason seem to be picked out in this. But as I've tried to explain to a lot of them, unfortunately, the young men who are not so healthy are part of the statistics of some people who died suddenly from COVID. So it's kind of very unusual in that way. It makes you go back into your own medical education and try and find, not so much an explanation, but to try and use basic principles that you'd learn in medical school to try and understand what you're trying to treat, because you're looking for things at a very sort of microscopic level that you might be able to impact. you're using drugs that people use for other conditions to see if you can manage a symptom. And at the same time, you know, the bigger challenge is just to try and raise awareness, get people vaccinated, and identify sick people so you can try and help them. So it's really one of those kind of unusual events in medical and life's history. But I think as a nation and I think as a world, we've done remarkably well in containing it and managing it. And I think we do have to acknowledge that instead of trying to criticize every stakeholder for we could have done this better and we could have done that better.
Yeah, I know. And I mean, there was so many different opinions of people like, you know, anti-vaccination and don't do this and it's a conspiracy, you know. And I mean, it was just really, really strange, the whole thing. I mean, for you, I suppose, when you look at this over the years, I mean, we look back to Spanish flu, you look back to, you know, massive epidemics, things. I mean, are these just things that we are kind of going to get used to, I suppose, humanity going down the years, that these things just happen? Where do they come from? Who knows? I mean, the China, you know, all the theories about it came from a wet market. And I mean, it's so fascinating, but obviously interesting to try and get to the source of it all.
Yeah, I think it is. I think, as you say, there are such complexity around where, what, if, when. Certainly, you can see an awful lot more illnesses coming through the animal population being spread into humans. You can also see that, you know, there are countries around the world that do and do not share as much information to disclose things. So it'll always be a little bit of kind of, well, conspiracy, as you might like, which feeds that certain element of people about who have their own opinions about COVID and the right to vaccinate and what stories are being told, which is very unhelpful, I might add, to the population. And then I think that, you know, the Spanish flu and other illnesses again emerged in different time frames where healthcare was very, very different. Obviously, the world is 100 years ago. So you're in situations where your mortality would be even higher back then as a consequence of really the context around it. And I think there will be another COVID type of infection that will spread. I think society is not as healthy as we'd like it to be. And I think it might well come around again before another 100 years. But you'd really hope there's been enough lessons learned here in terms of some of the way we do healthcare that will identify things earlier, that will share information perhaps more openly across the world. We try and help each other like we seem to do through COVID, and that we'll learn from it. But, you know, time will tell.
From yourself, I mean, did you always want to get into medicine yourself?
So my journey into medicine is that I sort of decided, I'd say in fifth year in school, that, yeah, I wanted to do medicine. Now, my father, who died 3 years ago, actually during COVID, but not from COVID, was a surgeon in St. Vincent's Hospital. He was a urologist. My mother was an eye surgeon in the same hospital. I'm the eldest of four children. My younger brother sadly died suddenly when he was in medical school in his 20s. He was a year younger than me. I went on through medical school and really, really was delighted with the choice of doing that. And I have two younger siblings, one of whom, my younger sister, is also an eye specialist. So there's a very significant family tradition around medicine. It's not that I was forced into anything. I always remember my dad saying to me, you have to make the decision yourself. Which is probably the most difficult thing you could ever say as a parent to a child, because you're of an age where you really don't know. But at the same time, I have three children who are all trying to decide what they want to do in life. And I've been very careful not to force them into any direction, because the truth is most of my medical colleagues will tell you that their children don't want to do medicine. But the irony is most of my law colleagues will say that their children don't want to be lawyers either. So it's I at the time it felt right for me. I have no regrets since I did it. I absolutely enjoy and love my job and love what I do for other people.
Now, I know you have some amazing advice that you want to give us later in the program. In terms of us as a country, in terms of worlds, I mean, how are we doing? I see obesity is a huge problem now. It seems to be worse than anything. Results of over-processed food, I don't know. I mean, are we kind of reaching this epidemic now of ill health?
Oh, I think we've reached it already. I mean, I think while COVID is an interesting, acute, major problem in the world, there is a publication in The Lancet from last week which shows that approximately 1 billion, that's one in five people in this population of the world, are obese, which is just alarming. And, you know, we had spoken, I was at a public health interesting meeting in the Caribbean last week, which was looking at the public health issues in that part of the world. And as much as you might fancy the Caribbean is one of the most unhealthy places in the world when it comes to local populations. I mean, the obesity rate is over 60% of their population. But what you also learn from public health is not just the individual patient, but the countries as a whole. And you will see that what's really driven the changes in weight in particular is that they import a lot of their food. It is full of unprocessed contents. And that it seems to be driving a significant increase in weight. There is that other situation where they drink a lot of sugar-containing drinks. So those two factors have a huge contribution. So it's not, it's much more to do with that. They're not eating healthy foods because they don't have access to it. And it's interesting, I looked at another part of the world, which is in the southern parts of Africa, the sub-Saharan parts of Africa, who have exactly the same problem. And you know, we all remember growing up, Africa was associated with famine and malnutrition. But now we have this double problem. It's also associated with obesity. And again, areas of the world where poverty is causing you to look for food at all costs. And what's available to you is not the healthiest food. And you gain weight from that food. And that food ups the risk of all the nasty chronic diseases of this world.
Yeah, it's amazing because when you think of the Caribbean, you think of sun and you think healthy. You know, coconuts and sort of coconut oil, which we're all told we should be cooking with now and so. But that's incredible. So is it the Mediterranean diet you hear about, you know, Japanese people living to be 150, you know, and it's fish and it's pork and obviously the climate as well. I mean, is it basically down to that sort of diet?
I think one of the eye openings I would have had from the meeting I was at was that your health is not just your behaviors in terms of as simple as I eat the wrong food, I smoke cigarettes, I drink too much, I don't take any exercise. Yes, they are absolutely essentially important individual behaviors. And yes, they all cause health problems. But if you look behind them and you identify what are called your social determinants of health, or as a recent publication calls them, commercial determinants of health, there's an awful lot of other factors that influence your health. So where you live, the country's economic situation, your access to healthcare. Tradition is huge. One of the interesting things in the Caribbean, in Curaçao as an example, is that women are traditionally those big, larger women. And that is a legacy. And men are attracted to those types of women because they believe that skinny women are unhealthy. And these larger women are perceived to be more powerful. In Curaçao, where I was, they have this little doll called a chichi doll. And a chichi doll is that big individual who's seen as the older daughter in the family, who tends to be a model of power, a role model for younger siblings, who helps their mum out. So there's an extraordinary cultural aspect to what are considered overweight individuals and the role they play in families in that part of the world. And very similar family traditions in Africa as well, where the sort of traditional sort of hunter-gatherer go out and get all the food. That group of people all grew up in communities. The hunter-gatherers were all families together going out and feeding. And yet you hear terrible stories in Africa in terms of who gets to be fed, who gets the food, and all the problems that are associated with that. So it's not just what you think are the obvious. It's much more complex than that. And one of the interesting things about the meeting brings up very important topics, which is, so if you take Chile as a country in South America, Chile have been innovative and incredible in terms of food labeling. And I mean food labeling in a nice, simple way, like red, like a traffic light system. Because most of us can't read or understand anything that's written on a food label on the side of a packet of anything. So at least it's not how much fat, how much carbohydrate. It's like, this is not healthy for your health. This is bad for lung cancer. This is bad for your children. This is bad for adults. You work it out from that. So that's informative. In Mexico, they have done huge progress in terms of sugar tax. Mexico is very interesting. There was the head of the Department of Public Health in Mexico at the meeting who presented really good information to show that sugar taxes work. The challenge when you tax for sugar and tax for food is that you want to be sure that the money is coming back into the health system and it's not going off to pay for something else. And I think the really important message in that is ultimately about trying to find ways to get the bigger companies who make all these products to engage and be part of the health solution as much as they are with everything else. But again, the system is not as simple as that. There's an awful lot of other issues. One of the other most fascinating things as well is that, you know, like COVID, we all travel around the world. And I think that as much as you go on your holidays, as I said, blind patients, you pick up COVID in airplanes. You you pick up illness by virtue that different countries have different traditions. I mean, it's
even though we're told it's the best filtration and
absolute, but it's not. But being on your own and doing nothing is much worse for you than not traveling. So it is important. And as you can see from what I'm saying, you do get exposed to cultures. You start realizing that there's a little bit more to the way that we make choices in life. It's not to give them as excuses to say, well, I'm not doing that. I was made that way. But it's more to understand that things are a little bit more complex. We can all do something. There are bigger things that governments can do. There are things that we can all do as individuals. And ideally, if we do it together, we'll be in a much better position than if we don't.
I spent a lot of time traveling, and my job as a travel journalist as well, Professor Kelly, but Norway was one country, of course, very rich with oil, etc., and but massive sugar tax, massive alcohol tax. But yet, you can literally drive across the border into Sweden and you can stock up on bars of €1 chocolate, which I think they tend to do. So it's funny what you were saying about things trickling down to the right places, and you look at other cultures. It's a difficult one, isn't it?
Oh, it's really, really difficult. I mean, there's parts of the Middle East where the sugar tax is also 50%. And in the Middle East, alcohol is frowned upon. So, you know, again, you can access things outside of these countries. Now, I think they're proactive steps. I think clearly, as we said before, it would be great if industry were more proactively involved in health, as much for their own employees as for a nation. Yeah, and it would be wonderful if we kind of were more holistic in terms of we approach this. I think the other thing that's really important is that at the end of the day, you, the individual, have to look after your own health. You can't wait for somebody to bring in a sugar tax to look after your own health. You can't wait for the world to change and legislate that you can't go from Norway into wherever. You know, you have to make your own decisions because you have to look after your own health.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I think that is something that when you see America and different places, when I go to America, which I love traveling to, when I watch TV, it has all cars and food. So, I mean, you know, it's almost like subconsciously, subliminally going into people's minds. And it doesn't look like the healthiest of food, like, you know, when you see the ads. So I guess it's not a nanny's estate approach, but in terms of becoming healthier, you would say it's an overall approach in terms of all the different, like health, wealth, what you're eating, sorry, you know, exercise and stuff. So is that, what is the most, if you were to say to somebody, this would be one of the real good things that you can do to change your life. I presume it's diet, is it?
So let me just take a step back. So I am a cardiologist. I treat heart patients. I treat people who are concerned with things like blood pressure, obesity, cholesterol, diabetes. And those conditions are all related to food. But I'm also a lifestyle medicine doctor. And the lifestyle medicine component is about preventing, treating, and potentially reversing a lot of those conditions. So you can reverse all those conditions if you change diet, in theory. So, I mean, yes, the most valuable things that you can do when it comes to your health are to change your diet and also to be active. I mean, it's very clear that if you take exercise at least sort of 9 or 10,000 steps, that you can cut your heart disease risk by about 40%. And in fact, even if you just do 2 or 3,000 steps, you reduce your heart risk and you reduce your disease risk. So moving around is much, much healthier for you than not. And then in conjunction with that, in terms of changing your eating habits, you know, it's about eating more healthy. And eating most healthy is best evidence. In other words, the best amount of scientific data comes from eating a whole food plant-based diet, which a lot of people don't like the idea that they get deprived of meat. But the Mediterranean diet is literally the same thing, but it allows you to eat chicken and fish. And really what's frowned upon is all the processed meat, the stuff that comes out of the packets, the stuff that comes out of those locations that you mentioned in America. I think the other challenge with eating, particularly in parts of the Western world, is most people eat too much food. If you look at those parts of the world called the blue zones, where people claim they live over 100, and one of the things about the diet that makes a big difference in those parts of the world is that you eat till you're 80% full. You don't have to eat everything that's on the plate. I suppose the cultural comment, as we mentioned, is that since we've had the famine in Ireland, I think we all think that the food's going to run out again, a little bit like the Spanish flu and COVID, which is not the case because ironically, the potatoes are probably the most unhealthy food in our diets. And the reality is we should be going for more of the green things in our diets, which make up the Mediterranean diet. And the Mediterranean diet and the whole food plant-based diets both cut the risk for developing heart disease, for developing cancer, for dying prematurely, for having a stroke, and also they cut the risk of Alzheimer's disease. And yes, we all find reasons, sure, I can't do that. And that's where you have to take on board the other factors of your life and work around those. to make the diet better.
Yeah, and in terms of diets, I mean, you see there, you know, people saying, oh, you know, keto, ketogenic, and then like low carb. And yes, I mean, when I look at Italy, when I go to Italy, I mean, you have the most amazing pasta, pizza, which I know isn't healthy, but yet they all seem to be very slim and attractive. And is it just because they drink a bottle of olive oil a day or what? Or is that just my naivety?
No, I don't think it's your naivety. I think there's one of the interesting things, if you look at France. Now, I've had an experience of traveling to France for a medical meeting many years ago, and I sat on a table with a number of men and women. And the lady beside me, it was a four-course meal. Her only bad habit is she kept on slipping out for a cigarette between each course, which a lot of French women do. Now, she was very skinny. She had one glass of red wine, which she drank half of. When the starter came around, which I recall, I think was a bowl of soup, she had two spoonfuls of the soup. Now, she did leave then and go for a cigarette. And then when she came back for the main course, which I think was a duck breast and some vegetables, she ate the vegetables. She had one bite of the duck breast. Again, she left the table for another cigarette. And then there was a piece of chocolate cake and cheese that came around following courses, as they do in France. She had one teaspoon bite of the chocolate cake and she didn't touch the cheese at all. And then she had a lot of water. And I said, now I understand why French women are so thin. They eat very little food. So I have been quoted in the past of saying a little bit of everything is good for you. Now, a little bit of everything is good for you is tiny. It's like the butter patty. It is not a big mound of butter that you think is the size of your fist. And the problem is you take big things like that and then you spread it on lots of pieces of white bread, which are not good for your health either. So there is a little bit of honesty in terms and responsibility in all of this. And I think that Italy, it's probably a portion size issue. I think if you eat a smaller portion, you can get by on eating more tomatoes, which are healthy. The odd glass of wine is actually healthy. The olive oil comment is it's extra virgin olive oil. Olive oil of itself is not that healthy. When you start frying food with extra virgin olive oil, the extra virgin benefit goes away. So it's natural. You add it to salads. That particular
That's interesting.
That particular food is really good for you.
That's interesting because I know Italians, they never eat butter and they just, I mean, it's a thing here. They dip the bread in olive oil. So that is actually very interesting. Yeah, I've heard that before as well. And you hear, of course, about coconut oil, you know, that you should be using this. And then you hear, but some people say, oh, butter's the best. Don't use margarine because it's a polyunsaturates. And your mind is like, what should I do? You know, but the extra virgin olive oil is a very good tip. Yeah. In terms of for people, Professor Kelly, that would understand, a lot of people, blood pressure, for example, where does it come from? Cholesterol, what, you know, be very interesting to tell us, you know, what actually causes blood pressure.
So when it comes to blood pressure, you know, about 60% of the population have blood pressure. And it mostly comes in people who are older, but older is like my age group, mid-50s and above. And blood pressure is contributed to by family history, although very, very small in that respect. A lot of people just get blood pressure. In fact, about 95, 96% of people just get blood pressure. Now, it's contributed to by your lifestyle. So, I mean, being very inactive, eating a lot of salt, overeating in terms of food, as we've mentioned, and probably stress, you know, contribute. Some women during pregnancy get blood pressure. And I think the other aspect of it that's important is alcohol consumption and coffee consumption definitely lead to higher blood pressure. So, you know, there's a lot of simple causes there that, as I've said before, you can undo, particularly either A, you have a family history of blood pressure, or secondly, if you develop a bit of blood pressure that you've been checked out and it comes up that way. Cholesterol is probably a very similar story. Some people do have higher cholesterol. Some people contend that, well, sure, it's just in the family, but mom and dad are perfectly healthy. I don't feel that you can do that because your risk in the family is about 20% of any condition. You can't make the assumption that the other 80% doesn't matter, because if you're eating all the wrong foods and doing all the unhealthy things, it doesn't matter what your parents' risk is. It really matters your own behavior. And I think that in cholesterol, the vast majority comes from that 80%, and the vast majority will either respond to you changing your behavior and or the need for taking certain medications to help you do that. And in fact, the medications are not to be frowned on, despite stories about statins causing dementia and other stories, which are totally unsubstantiated. But the reality is there's a benefit in reducing the risk again of having heart attacks and having strokes. And it's a very, very significant benefit reduction. So, you know, I think while people would love to have all these problems just go away, most people choose to try and ignore them. And if you do that, there are consequences.
Yeah, and on the cholesterol, I mean, that's very interesting, because I would have thought, I know some friends of mine, one girl in particular, who has, it's almost genetic. She's up at 9 point something. She's done all, you know, whatever the higher percentage of the medication is, and nothing seems to work. But dementia, I mean, obviously, because we're all living longer, there seems to be everybody, second person you seem to hear, seems to be suffering from dementia. It seems to be huge now. But that, from, is that because, again, thicker blood, cholesterol, that's just, how does that happen in terms of the brain for people? So, what can you do to try and prevent that?
So in terms of dementia, there are different types of dementia and different reasons that your brain either gets injured or doesn't work as well. So, you know, if you have a lot of strokes, which is a vascular problem, parts of your brain will die and won't work properly, and you may well lose your memory and you may well become demented. Other people get Alzheimer's disease, which is not due to blood vessels. So it's not the cholesterol and it's not the blood pressure. It's due to a different condition, which relates to changes in proteins within your brain. But the one thing that unifies both conditions is your life. And so if you live a very unhealthy life, unfortunately, you're more likely to end up with things like dementia. Whereas if you look after your diet, if you don't smoke, if you curtail your alcohol intake, if you manage your stress, if you look after aspects, even the connections and the family time you spend in life, well, then you significantly reduce your risk of developing dementia, just like the risk of every other illness.
I saw some really interesting elderly ladies that were over 100 being interviewed from different countries in this documentary, and they all talked about not taking life too seriously. And I know we talked about very important things earlier, and one lady was saying she was Italian, like she laughed, she didn't take life. Now, I think in Ireland we're not too bad at that, but it does seem to be more and more evident, and like being convivial as well. Is that the case? Because it seems to be an awful lot of people living longer here.
So I think it's a really interesting topic of conversation. I get a lot of patients who attend other cardiologists who come to see me, and I go, why are you here? And he said, well, because my other cardiologist has fixed my heart. I want to live forever. Can you make that happen? And I'm kind of saying, well, you know, there is this TV program. It's all about these blue zones in the world where people are documented to live over 100. Yes, that social conviviality is hugely important. They talk about your tribe or the people you hang out with having a significant bearing of probably about a 30% component to how long you live in life. And that factor that more optimistic, positive, grateful people do tend to live longer and do tend to respond much better to treatments like chemotherapy, like heart medications compared to sort of depressed, worrying, negative-minded people. So that's fascinating. And then all those lifestyle features we mentioned are all part of the blue zones. And you talked about dipping the bread in the extra virgin olive oil. There's an area of the world in Sardinia which has an area on the side of a hill which is associated with longevity. Now, you can't go on holidays in Sardinia and think 2 weeks will give you the longevity genie and come home and you live for 100. It doesn't work that way. But what's interesting as well is they make their own bread. They make a sourdough type of bread. Now, Italians do make an awful lot of their own food. And so they dip it in the small amount of olive oil. They don't add all the other foods. They live on a side of a mountain, so they go an awful lot of walking up and down. They're all together in a community, which is very much universal across all the different countries in the world where you tend to live longer. And so it really is those basic common sense things in life actually that give you a longer life. I mentioned those hunter-gatherers of before, where a lot of them obviously died. They were eaten by the animals they were chasing, or, you know, they didn't have healthcare, obviously. So I think the innovations in healthcare have made a big difference as well to extend life. We have much more diagnostic tests that pick up illnesses. We have much more treatments. And we also have much more interventions, particularly in cardiology. We have devices to stop your heart stopping called defibrillators. We have stents that can keep your arteries in your heart open. So there is a combination of factors, but there's no doubt that when you look at the people who live longer, they haven't needed any of the technology. They've actually looked after themselves in life. And as you mentioned about the happiness in life, happiness as a factor is incredible in terms of its bearing, in terms of how long you live.
Very, very interesting. And I mean, cholesterol, of course, you know, people get worried when it gets up to 6 point something. Now, just explain to us the good and bad cholesterol. I mean, that's obviously because it depends, doesn't it?
So I think the lesson on the cholesterol and the blood pressure, a bit like your bank account, is to know your numbers. Know your numbers. I mean, you need to know how much is in your bank account to pay your bills and everything else in life. But, you know, so when it comes to cholesterol, the number shifts all the time. But we like to look at what's called your LDL cholesterol. That's your low-density lipoprotein. So that is effectively your bad cholesterol. So nowadays, the guideline on that is to try and get it down to about 2. And the reason for that is we know that if we can get it down to 2, we can reduce the risks of having a heart attack by almost less than 5%. So it's just absolute, almost magic to do that. And the vast majority of people will not achieve that with diet alone. So that's why an awful lot of people end up on treatment. The HDL is your good cholesterol. You know, the higher you get that versus the lower you get that, you protect the risk for your heart. Most people do not have a high HDL cholesterol. And then the total is merged out at those two numbers combined with another fraction of your blood because your triglycerides. And your triglycerides are largely fat in your blood. And most of that comes from eating sugary foods, eating too much cheese, dairy, and then also the contribution of alcohol. So you see triglycerides rising in lots of patients. And so there's a big emphasis on additional tablets to statins at the moment to try and treat that. But the bottom line is, if you have high cholesterol, you need to look at your own way of living your life and whether you can make changes. But the second aspect, which is equally important, is to get yourself checked out. Because if you have evidence of heart disease with cholesterol, you should be on a statin. If you don't have evidence of heart disease, there are options to try and improve your diet, like the Mediterranean diet, or making in the situation of blood pressure. There's another diet, it's called the DASH diet, which is all about trying to reduce the intake of salt. And if you do that and control your blood pressure, well, then it's valuable because you reduce the risk of having a stroke. And nobody wants to have a stroke.
No, absolutely not. Now, you hear a lot about, you know, lecithin, and people are always talking about supplements, you know, that these are great. I mean, I know there's lecithin in eggs, and then you hear about the yolk and the white. And I mean, clarify, what's your take on that?
So lots of people like supplements. In fact, there are parts of Ireland. I gave a talk in a part of Cavan a couple of years ago, and people were asking me, is it all right to take this? And it's all right to take that. And then I asked the chemist, I mean, what was going on? She said, well, the local GP has retired, Dr. Kelly. So all the patients come into the chemist looking for alternative treatments. And in fact, there are parts of the world where, you know, in Southern Africa, they don't trust modern medicine. They all take alternative remedies that they get from Eastern medicine as a way to treat their ailments. Now, the truth is, when you come to the Western world where we all live and you look at the evidence in medicine, none of those supplements make any difference whatsoever in terms of how long you live in life or in terms of your risk for heart disease or your risk of premature death. However, lots of people do find benefits from taking supplements for things like joint pain, for memory, for some of the side effects of medicine. So, I mean, statins sometimes cause muscle cramps. So people will take a thing called CoQ10. Lots of people for longevity feel if you add turmeric to your coffee that it may help. Lecithin is of the rage where the egg white or the egg yolk and whether you should do more eggs or less eggs, whether you should eat butter versus low-fat butters. I think the bottom line in a lot of that is if you have a good, healthy diet, you will get all your supplements within your diet. You will get all your vitamins and all your minerals within your diet. Now, if you're on a food restriction program because of the fact that you have a medical condition, yes, you may need to take multivitamins. There's actually very good evidence that the diet can improve things like your menopause. You don't need to take a lot of vitamins because you can get that in the diet. And then clearly we're in a country where we don't necessarily get a lot of sunlight. And so vitamin D during the time of COVID has actually been shown to be really, really beneficial to your health. So taking an extra vitamin D supplement is probably one vitamin that definitely does have a medical benefit. So, you know, the bottom line is your diet is the source of all those. Whether you like to take the extras because they give you some improvement in your well-being, that's down to you. Whether you expect them to replace the benefits in terms of lowering your blood pressure, your cholesterol, living forever and not having a heart attack or a stroke, I'm sorry to tell you that that doesn't actually add up.
Yeah, no, very good. Living forever could be quite scary, depending on your quality of life. In terms of checking yourself out, I reckon there's a lot of us in our 50s walking around that have problems with our heart and we don't even know about it. I mean, you need to take a deep dive, do you? What's the advice on that?
So the first thing I would say is that to everybody who listens, your health is about today, it's about now. It doesn't matter what age you are. So if you are a teenager, you're smoking cigarettes, you're drinking a lot of alcohol, you're doing other things, they're not good for your health. If your health is important, if you see mom or dad has a medical problem, you have to make some considerations around that. So the age shouldn't matter. Now, in terms of where you engage with the hospital system or the GP, I mean, it's really important that you keep an eye on things like the blood pressure and the cholesterol and the weight, as we've spoken about. it's also really important that you do that early on in your life. Now, I'm not saying all the teenagers need to go into the doctor tomorrow, but I am suggesting, you know, women are very fortunate once they adhere to going for things like breast screening or cervical smear screening. You engage the medical professional. You have a great opportunity. Somebody can check your blood pressure. They'll weigh you. They'll do other things. Most of us, we only, particularly in men, the only interaction you get is you go for an insurance policy for your mortgage and they ask you questions about how heavy you are. And then they turn around and say, you must go and see the doctor to get checked in and measured. So you get a lot of opportunities, or those people who do medicals, you get a lot of opportunities to see that you have issues, even if though you can already see them yourself. So it's really the challenge is getting you to do anything about those things. And then in tests, I strongly advocate for a test. It's called a cardiac CT scan. Now, it's a CT coronary angiogram. It's not a calcification score. It looks at plaque. And when you're younger, you can get plaque that's not hard. That's why the calcification score can miss this. And I really advocate this because I see people in their 40s having heart attacks. I've had patients in their 30s having heart attacks. So yes, you should see a GP. Yes, you should check in on the cholesterol and the blood pressures and the weights. But you should also consider having these tests done earlier on in life, usually in your 40s, to get checked over. But you shouldn't wait till you're 40 to look after your health. And you shouldn't wait till you're 100 in the notion that you live forever without looking after your health, because you won't reach 100. And one of the ironies in life is a lot of people who retire find they become very unhealthy the weeks or the months after they retire. A lot of it's because you kind of lose the purpose in life, where you're very used to having a routine and you start to get sick for that reason. But the other thing is a lot of people don't look after their health. They put things off. Sure, I'll do it when I'm 65. And a lot of people in my world don't reach 65. They die suddenly. They die earlier. So the message here is, you know, start now, start today. Do something that improves your health, be it that you stop smoking, be it that you add some vegetables to your dinner tonight, or be it that you do something small in terms of physical activity. Maybe you know, get off the bus one stop earlier to walk into work, or maybe you just get out in the fresh air with the dog or with your family just to spend some time with them.
Yeah, I noticed a lot of people took to sea swimming, Professor Kelly, during COVID. And again, apparently the sudden shock to the immune system is meant to be very good as well. And a lot of people seem to be taking to that and immersing themselves in tubs of hot, or cold tubs, should I say, of ice as well. Is that also something good?
So you got to be careful with that. So I live near the sea in Monkstown. I think the challenge is, you know, again, one of those social determinants of health is I'm not sure how clean the water is all the time, because when the tide is in, everybody's swimming. When the tide is out, the water isn't necessarily blue as it should be. So I think that the challenge with sea swimming is that if you're the unhealthy person, and one of the warnings here is that if you're the athlete, do not make the assumption that you will never have a heart attack, because plenty of athletes have died suddenly at younger ages. Now, I'm not talking the sudden deaths. I'm talking middle-aged athletes who die suddenly, quite often from heart attacks. And it's not that they're all at home being totally unhealthy. It's a reality of life. It's a reality of the risk of heart disease. So, you know, if you're going swimming in the sea, you've got to ensure that you're in good health, because immersion in the cold water very suddenly, where you're not used to doing it before, can actually trigger cardiac events, and it can actually trigger fatal cardiac events. So I know a lot of spouses get worried about their partners going into the sea when they're not the healthiest. You see the same on the middle-aged group who all like to take up cycling because everybody else is doing it, having never been on a bicycle before in their lives, probably not since they were a child. And so there is an element of looking after yourself, engaging with your health and getting checked out, and not using what you think as a kind of a quick fix, which is the problem that most people have. I think there's a big rage around the baths, and from Mr. Van Hoff or Wim Hof, who spends most of his time, as far as I can see, in ice baths. But there's plenty of other personal development gurus in the world who propose the same. Again, I think you have to be careful on the person you are when you do that. I suppose during COVID, one of the challenges, a lot of people were saving money. So having your bath in the sea was one excuse. But the other thing is, it became very, very popular. I mean, you know, as I said, where I live, you'd have hundreds, if not thousands, of people wandering around, going in the sea, social distancing, everybody buying the dry robes to as the new kind of uniform to hang out. And ironically, that because COVID went on so long, people have developed a lovely habit of sea swimming now. So it really is the in pastime at the moment.
Very interesting. I mean, when you talk about cycling there, cycling around Dublin could be very, very stressful and not good for you at all. Whereas if you were in Denmark, it's quite joyful. You know,
well, actually, the irony in Denmark is that you get so many bicycles going down the streets together that it becomes quite competitive, almost like Formula One. So it's more likely that the cyclists will knock each other off the bikes. In Ireland, the problem is that the cycleways are smaller, so you're more likely the cars will knock the bicycles off their track.
Yeah. Now, it's been a great pleasure to talk to you this evening. Now, you have a program as well for people that want to really get serious about improving their health. You have a very good program people can sign up to. What are the details of that?
So I run a program to help people improve their health. Now, at the moment, I do it for a lot of my patients. I've actually done it for the staff in the hospital as well. And the challenge is to try and get you to improve one of those aspects of your lifestyle. So that would be maybe reducing your stress, getting you more active, improving your diet, helping you manage your sleep, which is a big challenge, and also trying to get you to stop smoking or reduce alcohol or get you off other addictive habits. So the program runs over 8 to 12 weeks. I essentially teach you how to change your behavior. I use a lot of the principles around what's called behavior design and teaching your habits. And it's a very, very simple process. So the way it's set up is I have a platform where people will watch a video, usually for a week or two. The purpose in that is so when you approach it every day, you'll learn something new. You apply that with a little bit of homework that I give you. And then I meet you every week. I do a Zoom call where I attend myself and I'll coach the group through what we're doing, answer any questions. And there's a couple of kind of novelties within the whole program. I do vision boards with men and women, which is quite innovative and a very interesting experience for people to actually see what they want in life. And that's really, really helpful to give you a little bit of focus as to what you want to do in your life for yourself and for your health. So you can look up that program. It's under drdr.robertkelly.ie. And then you can make inquiries through me here in the Beacon Hospital if you want to come and get checked out for your heart. I try to deal with the heart and the lifestyle as part of the more holistic way of doing this, because as we've said in the conversation, your life has a huge bearing on your health. And I think if you address your life or address small steps in your health, within every small step, and as long as you're making progress in the right direction, you'll be amazed over time. You'll be amazed to see how quick time goes by that, you know, it'll be Christmas before you know it. Just think if you ate one less potato every day, you might actually find that there's a couple of pounds of weight have fallen out of your trousers at the same time. So, I mean, the time to start is now, and you'll be amazed what you can achieve in a very short period of time.
Brilliant. Professor Robert Kelly, it's been a pleasure to talk to you this evening.
Thank you so much for having me.